and object. I see a swift increase in energy usage. Its reactor is increasing output.
It's awake, then,
Guyon declared, somewhat vacuously, in Holston's opinion.
I reckon it's still just automatic signals,
Lane guessed.
Tell it we're responding to its distress call.
Holston had already phrased a reply in scholar's language, which read as formally as an academy exercise, then had Lane and the Gilgamesh transcribe the message into the same electronic format the satellite was using. The waiting, as the signals danced across those millions of kilometres of void, was soon stretching everybody's nerves.
It's calling itself the Second Bryn Sentry Habitat,
Holston translated eventually.
It's basically telling us to alter our course to avoid the planet. Before Guyon could ask, he added, and it's not mentioning the distress call now. I think, because we've gone in with an answer to whatever it was signalling to the planet, it's that system we're interacting with.
Well, tell it who we are, and tell them we're coming to help them,
Guyon instructed him.
Seriously, I'm not sure.
Just do it, Mason.
Why would it be signalling elementary maths to the planet?
Vitas complained, to nobody in particular.
I can see all sorts of systems coming online, I think,
added her underling at the sensor suite.
This is incredible. I've never seen anything like it.
I'm launching some drones, both for the Sat and for the planet,
Cast announced.
Agreed, said Guyon.
It doesn't recognise us, Holston reported, frantically translating the latest message from the satellite, stumbling over its antique grammar.
It says we're not authorised here. It says something about biological hazard.
And at the shudder that went through the crew.
No, wait. It's calling us an unauthorised biohazard. I think it's threatening us.
How big is this thing again?
Cast demanded.
A little under 20 metres on its longest axis,
was the reply from the science team.
Well then, bring it on.
Karst, this is old Empire tech, Holston snapped.
We'll see what that's worth when the drones get there.
As the Gilgamesh was still fighting to slow down, the drones outstripped it rapidly, their own thrust hurrying them towards the planet and its lone sentinel at an acceleration that a manned craft could not have managed without pulping its occupants.
I have another warning to divert, Holston reported.
Look, I think we're in the same position as with the distress call. Whatever we're sending it just isn't being recognised by the system. Probably if we were supposed to be here, we'd have the right codes or something.
You're the classicist, so work them out,
Guyon snapped.
It's not like that. It's not like the old Empire had a single, what, password or something.
We have archives of Imperial transmissions, don't we? So just strip some protocols from those.
Holston sent a glance of mute appeal towards Lane, but she was avoiding his gaze. Without entertaining any hope whatsoever, he began pairing ID and greetings codes from those fragments of old Empire recordings that had survived, and throwing them at random towards the satellite.
I've got signal from the drones on screen,
Cast reported, and a moment later they were looking at the planet itself. It was still just a glint, barely distinct from the surrounding starfield, even with the best magnification of the drone's electronic eyes, but they could see it growing. A minute later, and Vitas pointed out the tiny pinprick shadow of its moon passing across the planet's surface.
Where's the satellite? Guyon demanded.
Not that you'd see it at this distance, but it's coming round from the far side, using the planet's atmosphere and the moon to bounce its signal to us.
Drone party's splitting off now, Cast reported. Let's take a proper look at this Bryn thing.
More warnings. Nothing's getting through to it,
Holston slipped in, aware that by now nobody was really listening to him.
Cast, remember no damage to the satellite once you contact,
Guyon was saying.
Whatever tech's there, we want it in one piece.
No problems. And there she is, starting our run right now.
Cast!
Relax, Commander. They know what they're doing.
Holston glanced up to see the drones fixing their aim at a point on the growing green orb's circumference.
Look at their colour,
Vitas breathed.
Unhealthy,
Lane agreed.
No, that's old Earth colour.
Green.
This is it, one of the engineers whispered. We're here. We made it.
Visual on the satellite,
Cast announced, highlighting a tiny glint on the screen.
This is the Second Bryn Sentry Habitat,
Holston read out insistently.
This planet is claimed by
the what?
Something. Exaltation program, and any interference is forbidden.
Exaltation what?
Lane asked sharply.
I don't know. Holston was racking his brains for references, hunting through the ship's archives. There was something about the old empire fell because it descended into sinful ways. You know the myth cycle? A few grunts of confirmation. The exaltation of beasts, that was one of the sins of the ancients. Karst let out a yelp of surprise, and moments later, the transmissions from his satellite-bound drones exploded into static.
Oh, shit! Everything heading for the satellite just died! He bellowed.
Lane, Guyant started. Already on it. Last moments of... A busy silence as she worked. Here, this is the last one to go, by about a second. There, brief power surges, and the other drones are gone. Then this one goes right after. It just blew your drones, Karst.
What with? Why would it need a... Look, that thing could be serious military hardware for all we know, Lane snapped.
Or it would need to be ready to track and deal with deep space object impact, suggested Vitas. Anti-asteroid lasers, maybe. Lane was frowning at the readouts. I'm not sure it did shoot. Karst, how open are the drone systems? The security chief swore. We are still heading towards it, Holston pointed out. Even as he said this, some of the other drone screens were dying. The machines Karst had been sending planet-side. The satellite was snuffing them out the moment it rounded the world enough to obtain line of sight.
What the fuck's going on?
Karst demanded, fighting for control, sending his last pair of machines zigzagging towards the planet. A moment later, there was a sudden energy spike, a colossal expenditure of power from the satellite, and one of the two surviving machines was gone.
Now that was a shot, Lane confirmed grimly. That atomized the bastard.
Karst swore foully as he coded instructions for the last machine, sending it spiralling towards the planet, trying to keep the curve of the horizon between the drone and the satellite.
Are those weapons a danger to the Gilgamesh?
Guyan asked, and the room fell silent.
Probably, yes.
Vitas sounded unnaturally calm.
However, given how much energy we've just seen, its ability to use them may be limited.
It won't need a second shot at us, Lane said grimly. We're not going to be able to deviate from this course, not significantly. We're already decelerating as much as is safe. We have too much momentum. We're plotted to come into orbit.
It's telling us to leave or it will destroy us, Holston said tonelessly. As the Gilgamesh's computers adapted, they became quicker at bringing him a comprehensible record of the signal, and he found that he was now reading the reproduction of an ancient script almost fluently. Even before any demands from Guyan, he was already phrasing his reply. Travelers in distress. Do not initiate hostile action. Civilian transport ship requires assistance. Lane was looking over his shoulder critically as he sent it.
It is adjusting its positioning,
from the science team.
Pointing at us, Guyan concluded.
It's an inexact comparison, but...
But yes, in the minds of everyone there. Holston could feel his heart hammering madly.
Travelers in distress, do not initiate hostile action. Civilian transport ship requires assistance.
But the message wasn't getting through. Guyan opened his mouth to issue some desperate order, but Lane burst out,
Send it back its own distress call, for fuck's sake!
Holston goggled at her for a moment, then let out a cry of some nameless emotion, triumph inextricably mixed with annoyance at not having thought of it himself. Moments later, it was done. There were some hard minutes then, waiting to see how the satellite would react, to see if they had been in time. Even as Holston returned the satellite's own distress signal to it, the attack could already have been sent leaping across space towards them, fast enough that they would not even know until it struck. Finally, Holston sagged back in his seat with relief. The others were crowding round, staring at his screen, but none of them had the classical education to translate it until he put them out of their suspense. Please hold for further communication, he told them, or something like that. I hope, it's gone to wake up something more sophisticated. There was a murmur of conversation behind him, but he was counting the minutes until the next transmission arrived. When the screen filled instantly with code, he was elated for a fraction of a second before letting out a hiss of exasperation.
It's gibberish. It's just a wall of nonsense. Why is it...
Wait, Lane interrupted him. It's a different sort of signal, that's all. Gilgamesh has matched the encoding with some stuff in your archives, old man. It's...
It's audio. It's speech.
Everyone was silent once more. Holston glanced around at a cramped room full of bald men and women, all looking in less than good health, still shivering from the after-effects of their unthinkably long suspension, and all unable to keep up with the revelations and emotional trauma of their current situation.
I'm honestly not sure who's even still following this.
Probably it's still an automated... he started, but tailed off, not sure if he even had the energy for the argument.
Right. Gilgamesh has done his best to decode, based on the fragments in archive, Lane reported. Everyone want to hear this?
Yes, Guyon decided. What came to them from the ship's speakers was hideous. A corroded, static-spiked mess in which a female voice could just be discerned. Nothing but isolated words breaking in and out of the interference. Words in a language that nobody but Holston could comprehend. Holston had been watching the commander's face, because it had been obvious to him what they would get, and he saw a spasm of rage spike there briefly before being fought down.
Oh, well, it's not good.
Mason, translate. Give me time. And if you can clean it up any, Lane.
Already on it, she muttered. Behind them, the others began speculating cautiously. What had been speaking? Was it merely an automatic message, or... Vetus was speculating on the old Empire's supposed intelligent machines. Not just a sophisticated autonomous engine like the Gilgamesh, but devices that could think and interact as if they were human, or more than human. Holston hunched over his console, phones to his ears, listening to the incrementally clearer versions that Lane was scrubbing for him. At first he couldn't understand more than a few words, having to slow the transmission down and focus on small slices of it, while trying to wrestle with a thoroughly unexpected intonation and pattern of speech. There was a lot of interference, too, a weird, irregular rise and fall of static that kept interfering with the actual message.
"I've got the drone into the atmosphere," Karst announced abruptly.
Everyone had almost forgotten him as he sent instructions to his one surviving remote, with no idea of whether each refinement to its course would arrive in time to prevent its destruction. When he had the attention of the majority, he added,
"Who wants to see our new home?"
The drone's images were grainy and distorted. A high-altitude scan of a world so green that one of the scientists asked if the picture had been recolored.
"You're seeing exactly what the drone's seeing," Karst assured them.
"It's beautiful," someone put in. Most others simply stared. It was beyond their experience and their imagination. The Earth that they remembered had not looked like this. Any such verdant explosion had been locked away in the years before the ice, and it never returned after the toxic thaw. They came from a planet immeasurably poorer than this one.
All right.
The conversation behind Holston had grown into a hubbub of speculation, then died away into ennui in the time it had taken him to adjust to the new transmission.
Translation here.
He sent it to their screens. The second Bryn Sentry Habitation acknowledges your request for assistance. You are currently on a heading that will bring you to a quarantine planet, and no interference with this planet will be countenanced. Please provide full details of your emergency situation so that habitat systems may analyze and advise. Any interference with Kern's world will be met with immediate retaliation. You are not to make contact with this planet in any way.
We'll see about that, Karst declared, and doesn't know about the last drone, then. I've said it so as to try and keep on the far side of the planet from that thing.
Mason was still playing back the message, trying to work out what that continuing interference was. Like the distress call, it sounded as though there was some other message hitching a ride along with the satellite's signal.
Is it still sending down to the planet?
He asked Lane.
It is, but I've compensated for that. You shouldn't be getting...
Kern's world?
Vitas noted.
Is that a name?
Kern and Bryn are phonetic, Holston admitted. If they're words, they're not in my vocabulary files.
What response?
Will it understand if we speak to it?
Guyon pressed.
I'll send an encoded message like before, Holston told him.
Whatever it is, it's not speaking Imperial C the way the textbooks think it should be spoken. Different accent, different culture, maybe. I don't think I could speak to it well enough to be properly understood. Send this.
Guyon shunted over a block of text for Holston to translate and encode.
We are the Ark ship Gilgamesh, carrying 500,000 humans in suspension. It is of utmost priority that we are able to establish a presence on your planet. This is a matter of the survival of the human species. We require your assistance in preserving our cargo.
It's not going to work. Holston wondered whether Guyon had somehow heard some other message from the satellite, because that wasn't an appropriate response as far as he was concerned. He sent it off, though, and returned to listening to the previous transmission, recruiting Lane to try and pass out the rider signal, to separate out something comprehensible. And then, abruptly, he began to hear it, listening between the words, stock still and gripping his console, as the meaning came through to him. The Second Bryn Sentry Habitation acknowledges your request for assistance. You are currently on a heading that will bring you to a quarantine planet, and no interference with this planet will be countenanced. Please provide full details of your emergency situation so that habitat systems may analyze and advise. Any interference with Kern's world will be met with immediate retaliation. You are not to make contact with this planet in any way.
Cold, so very long waiting. Why won't they come? What has happened? Can they all really have gone? Is there nobody, nothing left at all of home? So very cold. Coughing cold. Nothing is working, nothing left. Eliza, why won't you answer me? Speak to me. Put me out of my misery. Tell me they're coming. Tell me they're going to come and take me. Wake me, warm me from this cold. So cold.
Mason had kicked his seat back from his position, but the voice still droned and grated in his earphones, absolutely the same voice as the main message's formal efficiency, but twisted by a terrible despair. "We may have a problem." "New transmission coming through," from Lane, even whilst others were demanding to know what Holston meant.
"What should I do with the drone?"
Cast put in.
"Just sit on it for now. Tell it to keep itself blocked from communications with the habitat," Guyon told him. "Mason?"
But Holston was already working through the new transmission. It was a far shorter, punchier message than the first, but the word stuck in his mind. Habitat. That was my translation. Did the ancients mean that? They couldn't really have meant something for someone to live in. 20 meters across for however many millennia? No, that can't possibly...
It says, "Do we want to speak to Eliza?" he choked out.
Inevitably, someone had to ask, "Who's Eliza?" as though anybody there could have answered the question.
"We do,"
Guyon decided, which was just as well as Holston had already sent the response. Minutes later, the delay shorter each time as they neared the planet, something new spoke to them. Holston recognised the same voice as before, though considerably clearer, and still with that horrible stream of consciousness backing, constantly trying to break through. His translation for the others came swiftly. By now, he reckoned he must be as fluent in Imperial Sea as anyone had ever been in post-glacial history. He passed it around the others' screens.
"Good evening, travellers. I am Eliza Kearns, composite expert system of the Second Bryn Sentry Habitat. I'm sorry, but I may have missed the import of some communications that you have already sent to me. Would you please summarise what was said?"
There was an interesting split in the listeners then.
Command and security remained mostly unmoved, whilst science and engineering were thrown into sudden debate. What did the voice mean by expert system? Was Holston sure that was the proper translation? Was it actually an intelligent machine? Or just something pretending to be one? Holston himself was busy piecing together that background message, although he felt less and less happy about it. The words, the very tone of horror and desperation in his ears, were making him feel ill.
"Good evening, travellers. I am Eliza Kearns, composite expert system of the Second Bryn Sentry Habitat. I'm sorry, I may have missed the import of some communications that you have already sent to me. Would you please summarise what was said?"
"What are you doing? What are you in my mind taking? Why can't I wake up? What am I seeing? The void, only alone, and nobody, nothing. There is no ship. Why is there no ship? Where are there is no... Eliza Kearns has stolen me. Stolen mind.
Holston resent the Gilgamesh's last substantive transmission. "We are the Arkship Gilgamesh, carrying 500,000 humans in suspension. It is of utmost priority that we are able to establish a presence on your planet. This is a matter of the survival of the human species. We require your assistance in preserving our cargo." And the reply,
"I'm sorry, it will not be possible for you to approach or contact Kern's world in any way. This is an absolute interdiction in line with Exaltation Program guidelines. Please let me know if any other assistance may be given."
"Avrana, I'm Avrana's monkeys are all that matters. If everyone's gone, what do we have to exult in? Save exaltation itself, there can be no contact. Contamination, Sering will not win, we will exalt. But must it be so cold, slow, hard to think?
Same words from a different computer. Guyon spat angrily. Lane was looking over Holston's shoulder, staring at his translation of the second hidden voice. He saw her mouth the words, "The fuck?"
"Mason, I don't care how you phrase it. Dress it up as fancy as you like. It needs to understand that we're human and that we need its help," Guyon said. "If there's some old world way of overriding its programming, of getting through to whatever that is, we need you to find it."
"No pressure, then." But Holston was already planning out his response. It was not a linguistics problem, no matter what Guyon might think. It was a technological problem, but one that even Lane was surely little better equipped to deal with than he was. They were speaking to a functioning, autonomous Imperial system. The EMP-blasted hulks in orbit around Earth had contained nothing like it. "Eliza," he sent back, "we are in desperate need. We have travelled far from Earth to find a new home for that part of the human race we are responsible for. If we cannot locate such a home, then hundreds of thousands of human beings will die. Does your system of priorities allow you to take responsibility for such a result?" The Gilgamesh archives did not contain them, but Holston had an idea that he had read somewhere of some philanthropic rules imposed on the fabled old artificial intelligences.
"I'm sorry, but I cannot permit you to compromise the exaltation experiment at this time. I understand that you have other concerns, and I am allowed to tender such help as my priorities allow. If you attempt to influence the planet, then you will leave me no choice but to take action against your vessel." "What ship? Let me see, the ship is coming from Earth. But is it Sering's Earth or my Earth? Or no Earth is left for any ship to come. Silently, they stopped sending so long, so cold, so let me out, you bitch, you witch, Eliza, you stole my mind. My name can't keep me here. Let me wake, let me speak, let me die, let me be something."
So much for that. It really is just the same line as before. We've got nowhere except...
"What?"
Guyon demanded.
"I want to try something a bit lateral," Holston explained. "Is it likely to get us blown up ahead of schedule?"
"I don't think so."
"Then you try whatever you've got, Mason."
Holston steeled himself and transmitted a simple, surreal question. "Is there anybody else we could talk to?"
"You're taking the piss," Lane said in his ear.
"Better ideas?" "I'm engineering, we don't do ideas." He managed a weak smile at that one. Everyone else was on tenterhooks, awaiting the response. Save for Guyon, who was glowering at Holston as though his fierce regard could somehow inspire the classicist to greater efforts of antiquarianism.
"Would you like to speak to my sister?" "Please, please, 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 please!"
Lane swore again, and Guyon stared down at his own screen. Another murmur of baffled speculation was rising around them.
"Right, look, I have a theory," Holston explained. "We're talking to some sort of automated system still, obviously. Even if it's programmed to respond in a human-like manner. But there's something else. It's different. It seems less rational. So we could see if it will let us do things that the main expert system won't. Worst comes to worst, we could even turn it against the main system somehow. I don't know."
"But what is it?" Vitas asked him.
"Why would they have two systems?"
"Failsafe?" Holston suggested, because he was keeping his worst suspicions very much to himself.
"Try it," Guyon said. "Cast, I want some solutions if this turns ugly. Our current course will bring us into the planet's attraction at the right speed to make orbit. The only alternative is to stop decelerating now and just fly past and then..." "And then what?"
The question was plainly rhetorical, the hard-pressed commander showing the working of his sums.
"Then we set course for the next point on the star maps and somehow hope there's something different there? We've seen this planet now. This is going to be our home. Mason, tell it."
"Why, yes, Eliza. Please let us talk to your sister." Holston tried to match the expert system's polite and formal manner of speech. He was not sure what they would get back, and he was ready to shut down the comms if it was just that anguished mad babbling, because there could be no dialogue with that, no possibility of negotiating with that internalized storm of insanity.
"We're being told to stand by," he reported, when the instruction came.
After that, there was nothing else for a long time. The Gilgamesh continued to fall inexorably towards the green planet's gravity well. The satellite was still silent, when Lane and her team began their anxious watch over ship's systems, as the ancient Ark ship began to creak and strain at the unnatural imposition of an external source of mass, large and close enough to claw at the vessel's structure. Everyone there felt a subtle shifting. For the whole waking portion of the journey, their perception of gravity had come from the ship's gradual deceleration. Now an alien force was reaching for them, subtly tugging with insubstantial ghost fingers the first touch of the world below.
"All signs suggest stable orbit for now," Lane reported tensely. There followed a slow-motion comedy as deceleration ceased and then rotation began, gravity creeping across the floor to make a new home against the wall, and the Gilgamesh's consoles and fittings shudderingly adjusting. For a minute there was no point of reference, a room full of weightless people trying to remember their long-ago training, hauling on each other to get to the right surface before they could be slammed into it. In the commotion, awkwardness, and a series of minor medical calls, the whole business of their imminent destruction was almost forgotten.
"New transmission," Holston alerted them, as the signal came in.
In his ear, those same female tones sounded, but the intonation, the rhythm of the speech, was quite different, and stripped free of that tortured backing. "I am Dr. Evarana Kern, Chief Scientist and Administrator of the Second Bryn Exaltation Project," was his translation. Even through the filter of archaic Imperial Sea, the voice was stern and proud.
"What are you? What is your provenance?"
"That doesn't sound like a computer," Lane murmured.
"Of course it's a computer," Vita snapped. "It's simply a more sophisticated approximation of..."
"Enough!"
Guyon cut through the argument.
"Mason!"
"We are an Ark ship from Earth," Holston sent, "seeking permission to establish a colony on Kern's world." If the thing he was talking to was in any way human, he guessed that a little flattery couldn't harm.
"Whose Earth, though?
Sering's Earth or my Earth?" came the swift reply. Now that they were in orbit, there was barely any delay. It was almost like a real conversation. Real conversation with a faceless machine mind, Holston reminded himself. He sent his translation round the room, looking for help, but nobody had any suggestion as to what the satellite meant. Before he could give any kind of answer, a new transmission came in.
"I do not recognize you. You are not human. You are not from Earth. You have no business here. Eliza shows me all that she sees of you, and there is nothing of Earth in you. But why can I not see you for myself? Why can I not open my eyes? Where are my eyes? Where are my eyes? Where are my eyes?"
And then an abrupt cessation of the message, leaving Holston shaken, because that was it. A segue straight into the voice of madness, without a moment's warning.
"I don't think it's a computer," he said,
but soft enough that only Lane heard him. She was reading over his shoulder still, and nodded soberly.
"Our vessel is the Ark ship Gilgamesh from Earth. This ship was built after your time,"
he prepared and sent, with a bitter awareness of the sheer understatement implicit in that. He was dreading what they might receive back.
"Good evening. I am Eliza Kern, composite expert system I'm instructed to require you to return to your point of origin." "Send them away. I don't want them. If they say they came from Earth, they can go back. Go back. Go back. I don't want. Can't. No. 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 No."
"It's completely deranged,"
Cast stated flatly, and that with the benefit of only half of what was being said.
"Can we keep the planet between us or something?"
"Not and retain stable orbit,"
one of Guyon's team reported.
"Seriously, remember how big the Gil is. We can't just flit him about like your drones."
Holston was already sending, because Guyon had stopped dictating and it now seemed to be down to him.
"Return to Earth is not possible. Please, may we speak to your sister again, Eliza?"
Pleading for the life of humanity in a dead language, having to make the call between artificial intransigence and what he was increasingly sure was real human crazy. That other voice again, delivering a rant that he got down as,
"Why can't you just go back where you came from? Are you Sering's people? Did we win? Did we throw you out? Are you here to finish what he started?"
"What happened here?" demanded Vetus incredulously.
"What's Sering? A warship?"
"Earth is no longer habitable," Holston sent, even as Lane warned. "That's going to push her over the edge for sure, Mason." He had dispatched the message even as she said it, the hollow feeling in his stomach arriving a moment later. She's right at that. but there was a measure more sanity in Dr. Avrana Kern's voice when it replied.
Nonsense.
Explain. The Gilgamesh archives had histories, but whoever would have thought they would need translating into a language only historians were now interested in? Instead, Holston did his best. History 101 for the lost time traveller, based on best guesses as to what had actually happened beyond the dawn of his recorded time, back when the old empire had held sway. There was so little he could actually say. The gap between the last thing Kern must know and the earliest definite fact that Holston could rely on was insuperable. There was a civil war between factions of the empire, he explained. Both sides unleashed weapons the nature of which I do not understand, but which were effective in devastating higher civilization on Earth and completely destroying the colonies. He remembered seeing the eggshell ruins on Europa. The in-system colonies had all predated any apparent later expertise in terraforming that the Empire had come to possess. They had been hothouse flowers on planets and moons haphazardly altered to better support life, reliant on biospheres that must have required constant adjustment. On Earth, people had lapsed back into barbarism. Elsewhere, when the power had failed, when the electromagnetic weapons had destroyed the vital engines, or the electronic viruses murdered the artificial minds, they had died. They had died in alien cold, in reverting atmospheres, under corrosive skies. Often, they had died still fighting each other. So little had been left intact. He typed it all out. As though writing an abstract to a history text, he noted with dry precision that a post-war industrial society may have persisted for almost a century, and may even have been regaining some of the sophistication of its predecessors when the ice came. The choked atmosphere that had smothered the planet in gloom had shouldered out the sun, resulting in a midnight glacial cold that had left very little of that abortive rebirth. Looking back down the well of time, Holston could make no definite statements about those who were left, nor about the frozen age that followed. Some scientists had speculated that, when the ice was at its height, the entire remnant human population of Earth had been no more than 10,000 all told, huddling in caves and holes around the equator and staring out at a horizon rigid with cold. He went on into more certain waters, the earliest unearthed records of what he could truly think of as his people. The ice had been retreating. Humanity had sprung back swiftly, expanded, fought its small wars, reindustrialized, tripping constantly over reminders of what the species had previously achieved. Human eyes had looked to the skies again, which were crossed by so many moving points of light. And he told Kern why they could not go back. Because of the war. The Empire's war from thousands of years before. For so long, scholars had taught that the further the ice receded, the better for the world. And yet nobody had guessed what poisons and sicknesses had been caught up in that ice, like insects in amber, the encroaching cold protecting the shivering biosphere from the last excesses of Empire. "There is no returning to Earth," he sent to the pensively silent satellite. "In the end, we could not counterbalance the increasing toxicity of the environment. So we built the Ark ships. In the end, all we had was old star maps to guide us. We are the human race, and we've had no transmissions from any other Arks to say that they found anywhere to stay. Dr. Avrana Kern, this is all we have. Please, may we settle on your planet." Because he was thinking in human terms, he expected a decent pause then for his opposite number to digest all that potted history. Instead, one of the science crew shouted out, "New energy readings! It's activating something!" "A weapon?" Guyon demanded. And all the screens briefly went blank, then flared to life again, with nonsense scattering across them, fragments of code and text and simple static. It's got into the Gilgamesh control system," Lane spat. "It's attacking our security. No. It's through. Fuck, we're open. It's got full control. This is what it did to your drones, Cast, the ones it didn't just vaporise. We're fucked. Do what you can," Guyon urged her. "What the fuck do you think I can do? I'm locked out." "Balls to your cultural specificity, Mason. It's all over our fucking system like a disease." "How's our orbit?" someone asked.
I have no feedback, no instrumentation at all. Beta sounded very slightly tense. However, I've not felt any change in thrust, and mere loss of power or control should not affect our position relative to the planet.
Like all those hulks orbiting Earth, Halston thought helplessly. Those fried, dead ships, with the vacuum-dried bodies of their crew still in place after thousands of years.
Abruptly, the lights jumped and flickered, and then a face appeared on every screen. It was a bony, long-jawed face. That it was a woman's was not immediately obvious. Details kept filling in. Dark hair drawn back, skin shaded and textured, harsh lines about the mouth and eyes. Unflattering by modern criteria, but who could name the ancient aesthetics that this face acknowledged? It was a face from an era and a society and an ethnicity that time had otherwise erased. The kinship between it and the crew of the Gilgamesh seemed tenuous, coincidental. The voice that rang out through the speakers was unmistakably the same, but this time it was speaking the crew's own common language, although the lips did not sync.
I am Dr. Avrana Kern. This is my world. I will brook no interference with my experiment. I have seen what you are. You are not from my Earth. You are not my humanity. You are monkeys. Nothing but monkeys. You are not even my monkeys. My monkeys are undergoing uplift, the great experiment. They are pure. They will not be corrupted by you mere humans. You are nothing but monkeys of a lesser order. You mean nothing to me.
Can she hear us? Guyon asked quietly.
If your own systems can hear you, then I can hear you.
Kern's voice spat out.
Are we to understand that you are condemning the last survivors of your own species to death?
It was a remarkably mannered, patient display from Guyon.
Because it seems that is what you're saying.
You are not my responsibility, Kern pronounced. This planet is my responsibility. Please,
Lane said, ignoring Guyon when he gestured at her to shut up.
I don't know what you are, if you're human or machine or whatever, but we need your help.
The face froze, nothing but a still image for a handful of heartbeats.
Lane, if you've...
Guyon started, and then abruptly, Kern's image began to break up, distorting and corrupting on screen, features bloating or atrophying and then flickering into nothing. The voice spoke again, a plaintive whisper in its native tongue, and only Halston could know what it was saying.
I am human. I must be human. Am I the system? Am I the upload? Is there anything of me left? Why can I not feel my body? Why can I not open my eyes?
The other thing. The Eliza thing. It was mentioning some other help, Lane murmured, although surely even a whisper would be overheard. Can we just ask it?
I will help you, Kern said, speaking their language again, sounding calmer now. I will help you leave. You have all the universe except this world of mine. You can go anywhere.
But we can't,
Guyon started. Then Lane broke in.
I'm back in, checking all systems.
A tense minute to ensure that, at the very least, the ship's computer was telling her that everything was still working.
We've got new data flagged up. It's just dumped a whole load of stuff on us. The Gilgamesh recognizes star maps. Mason, I've received some stuff in that jabber of yours.
Halston scanned over the jumble of data. Not sure, but it's linked to the star maps. His mouth was dry.
Other terraforming projects? I think we've been given the keys to the next system. It's giving us destinations.
It's selling out its neighbours, was what he did not say, given that it was listening. It's bribing us to go away.
I think something here might even be access codes.
How far?
Guyon demanded.
Just under 2 light-years, Vitas reported briskly. Just a step, really.
Through a long, stressed silence, they waited for Guyon's decision. The face of Avrana Kern was back on some of the screens, glowering at them, twitching, distorting, reforming. Chapter 2.6 Metropolis. Negotiations with the locals have gone sufficiently well, now that Portia and her party have established their superiority, and the incumbents have lent the three travellers a male to serve as a guide in the lands to the north. The creature is slightly smaller than Portia's own male companion, but of a quite different character, bold to the point of impudence by Portia's standards. He has a name. Call him Fabian. Portia, whilst aware that males give themselves names, has very seldom needed to know any, even with the concentration of that gender to be found at Great Nest. She guesses that in a small family unit such as these locals, males are likely to be more self-reliant, therefore both more capable and more independently minded. Still, she finds his brashness off-putting. Bianca appears to find him less objectionable, and on their trip north, Portia catches Fabian displaying for her a tentative offer to give her his sperm. Bianca has not yet shown herself receptive, but Portia notes that she has not chased him off, either. Portia herself has put several clutches of eggs behind her. Females seldom depart Great Nest without having passed on their lineage, and she feels this current behaviour is distracting from their mission. On the other hand, Bianca has fought for her, and probably considers playing with this new male her reward. Portia only hopes she can keep her desires in check. It would be more diplomatically advantageous if Fabian was not killed and eaten during the throes of passion. They do not have to travel far to the north to see just what has been growing here at the edge of the Great Nest's web of awareness. Soon, they begin coming across felled trees, their trunks showing a combination of blackening, chewing, and surprisingly clean cuts, often painstakingly scissored into sections. Frequently, the entire root system has been unearthed as well, ensuring that nothing will regrow. The forest is under wide-scale attack, its fringes being gnawed away. Fabian can remember when there were more trees, he communicates. The clearing of land continues year to year, and Fabian's inherited understanding suggests that it is happening faster now than in his mother's time. Beyond that ragged edge, the other trees, the foreign trees, are set out in discreet stands. They are small and squat and bulbous, with fleshy leaves and trunks that are warty with protrusions. The exaggerated space between each copse is a firebreak, something the spiders are very familiar with. Their planet's oxygen levels are higher than Earth's. Lightning-sparked fires are a constant threat. What they're seeing is no work of nature. This is a plantation on a grand scale, and the labourers tending it are plainly visible. Everywhere Portia turns her eyes, there are more of them. And if she looks beyond the checkerboard of groves, she can make out a steep-sided mound that must be the upper reaches of the plantation owner's colony, the bulk of it being hidden underground. A pall of smoke hangs over it like bad weather. Portia's kin are well aware that they are not the sole inheritors of their world. Whilst they cannot know how the nanovirus has been reshaping life here for millennia, there are certain species she shares the planet with that her people recognise as something more than animals. The spitters are a low-end example, barely removed from a state of brute nature. But to look into their small, weak eyes is nonetheless to recognise that here is a thing of intellect, and hence danger. The western oceans that Portia's Great Nest looks over are home to a type of stomatopod with which her people have cautious, ritualised relations. Their ancestors were fierce, inventive hunters, equipped with unparalleled eyesight and deadly natural weapons, and used to living in colonies where negotiations over living space were common. They, too, proved fertile ground for the virus, and have developed on parallel lines with Portia's own kin. Perhaps because of their aquatic environment, perhaps because they are by nature prone to wait for prey, their society is simple and primitive by Portia's standards. But the two species have nothing to compete over, and in the littoral zone, they sometimes swap gifts, the fruits of the land in exchange for the fruits of the sea. Of more pressing concern are the ants. Portia understands the nature of ants. There are colonies near the Great Nest, and she has both personal and genetically encoded dealings with them to draw upon. It is the Great Nest's collective experience that ant colonies are complicated neighbours. They must be dealt with decisively. Left to themselves, they will always expand in a manner detrimental to any species that the ants themselves have no use for, which would naturally include Portia's own. They can be destroyed. Her inherited understandings include chronicles of such conflicts. But war, with even a small colony, is costly and wasteful. Alternatively, preferably, they can be accommodated and limited by careful manipulation of their decisions. Portia knows that ants are not like her people, nor like the spitters or the stomatopods of the western shallows. She knows that individual ants themselves cannot be treated with, communicated with, or even threatened. Her comprehension is coarse, of a necessity, but approximates to the truth. Each ant does not think. It has a complex set of responses based on a wide range of stimuli, many of which are themselves chemical messages produced by other ants in response to still more eventualities. There is no intelligence within a colony, but there is such a hierarchy of interacting and codependent instinct that it seems to Portia that some manner of entity is behind a colony's actions and reactions. With ants, the nanovirus has simultaneously failed and succeeded. Amongst the ants' network of reactive decision-making, it has inculcated a strategy of experimentation and investigation that approaches rigorous scientific method. But it has not led to intellect such as any human or spider would recognise. Ant colonies evolve and adapt, throw up new castes, investigate and make use of resources, devise new technologies, refine them and interrelate them. And all this without anything approaching a consciousness to direct it. There is no hive mind, but there is a vast and flexible biological difference engine, a self-perfecting machine dedicated to the continuance of itself. It does not understand how what it does functions, but it constantly expands its behavioural repertoire and builds upon those trial and error paths that prove fruitful. Portia's understanding of all this is very limited, but she has a grasp of how ants do and do not work. She knows that individual ants cannot innovate, but that the colony can, in a strange way, make what appear to be informed decisions. Application of force and reward, a narrowing of the colony's viable options so that the most advantageous is the one the spiders intend it to choose, can lead to a colony accepting boundaries on its territory and its place in the world, and even to become a productive partner. The colonies are perfect exponents of game theory. They will cooperate where that course is less costly and more beneficial than other strategies, such as all-out genocidal war. The colonies that she is already familiar with, near Great Nest, are surely less than a tenth the size of what she is now looking at. Fabian explains that there were once several warring colonies here, but one has become dominant. Instead of driving its lesser neighbours to extinction, the ruling colony has incorporated them into its own survival strategy, permitting their continuance in return for making them into extensions of itself, utilising food that they gather and technologies they have developed. It is this world's first superstate. Portia and the others have a brief, agitated conversation. This supercolony is far enough from Great Nest not to threaten it now, but they can look ahead and envisage that its very existence here endangers their people's future. A solution must be found, but to think through a plan like that, Portia's kin at home will need all the information she can bring back to them. They're going to have to continue their journey into the land of the ants. Fabian is surprisingly useful. He has travelled further than this himself. In fact, his family makes a habit of it. It is dangerous, but they have developed ways of minimising the risk of raising the alarm. And when hunting has been lean, the ants' larders are a last resort. A new column of ants has arrived, and they are here for timber. The spiders retreat further into the trees and watch as the insects set to work breaking up the already fallen trunks into manageable sections, using acid and the strength of their jaws. Portia is swift to spot something new, a cast that she has never seen before. Smaller branches are severed and carried off by unexceptional-seeming workers, but the large trunks are dealt with by ants with long, curved mandibles equipped with jagged inner edges. These they fix to the circumference of a trunk and move their mouthparts in incremental opposition, scoring around and around so as to cut a circular section away. Those mandibles did not emerge from the cocoon with the rest of the ant, however. They gleam in the sunlight, in a way quite unlike anything Portia has seen before. Rigid, toothed sleeves that make remarkably quick work of biting and sawing the wood into pieces. With Fabian taking the lead, the spiders ambush an ant logging party, trapping and killing them quickly and efficiently, then decapitating them and dissecting them for their scent glands. The ants are smaller than Portia, between 15 and 30 centimetres long, and the spiders are stronger, swifter, and far more efficient fighters one-on-one. What they must avoid is a general alarm, where large sections of the colonies are mobilized against them. The ants communicate principally by pheromones. To Portia's keen chemical senses, the air is thick with them. They use the ants' scent to disguise their own, and they carry the severed heads with them, secured to their abdomens. In extremis, they can try to divert ant attention by a morbid form of puppetry, manipulating the dead antennae of their victims in a pretense of communication. They travel swiftly. Their victims will be missed, but the initial response will target where they were, not where they are now. Their road is the high one. They travel through the upper reaches of the ants' plantations, and whenever they reach a firebreak, one of them scuttles across the intervening ground with a thread that then forms the spine of a temporary bridge. With their own scent disguised, they travel over the ants' heads and beneath their notice. Fabian demonstrates that the protrusions on the trunks of the ant-tended trees can be lanced with a fang to release a sweet, nourishing liquid, not unlike the honeydew of aphids, a taste they know the ants relish. This plantation agriculture is obviously a useful secret, and Portia adds it to the list of observations to include in her report when she returns home. For now, they press on towards the main colony mound, avoiding the ants where they can, killing them swiftly where they cannot. Each small alarm will contribute to a generally raised awareness across the nest, until significant insect resources are devoted to locating intruders whose presence has been deduced by the colony's ineluctable internal logic. Portia's goal is to investigate the central colony mound, which promises more secrets. During the day, the air shimmers over parts of it, and there are plumes of smoke venting from stubby chimneys. At night, some of the ants' entrances glow dimly. In the darkness of their home, the ants start fires in the oxygen-rich atmosphere, ignited by exothermic reactions from chemicals that certain of their castes can produce. Complex arrangements of internal passageways use the temperature differentials to stimulate airflow, heating, cooling, and oxygenating their nests. The ants also use fire for land clearance and as a weapon. Portia's world, the underlying geology that existed before the terraforming, is rich in shallow deposits of metals, and the ants dig deep to build their nests. In this colony, centuries of burning has led to charcoal production, and occasional inadvertent smelting has been systematized into the forging of tools. The blind watchmaker has been busy. Entering the mound itself is more than Portia dares, and she is tempted to leave with all the information she has gathered. Curiosity urges her on, though. Atop the mound, beneath the hanging shroud of smoke, is a spire that gleams in the sun, brightly enough to draw the eye. Like all of her kind, she is driven to investigate anything new. This reflective beacon is the highest point on the mound, and Portia wants to know what it is. Portia finds her band of infiltrators a vantage point in the nearest plantation to the mound and considers the paths taken by the chains of ant workers. Inside the brain that bulks out the underside of her body, she has fallen into a way of thinking that her diminutive ancestress would recognize, constructing an internal map of the world and then deconstructing that to find the best course to where she needs to go next. "I will go alone," she instructs Bianca. "If I do not return, then you must go home and report." Bianca understands. Portia descends by line from the tree that provided her watchtower and begins her journey, following the itinerary that she spent so long plotting. The ants follow particular paths that their constant travel has packed down into flat, smooth roads representing the most efficient routes. Portia navigates a delicate, cautious path between these thoroughfares. She moves haltingly, pausing, quivering, then drifting on, gauging the lightly gusting wind and letting her onward progress follow its patterns, as if she herself was nothing but some overlarge piece of wind-blown debris. The vibrations of her movement are swallowed up in the entropy of the world at large. With her scent disguised, she can ghost past the near-blind ants, as though she is invisible. The going gets more complex and more dangerous as she reaches the mound itself. Her careful plan knows constant amendment, and she comes close to discovery several times. Once, she uses the detached head of one of her victims, in a brief moment of feigned contact, to put off a wandering cleaner who is paying too close attention to her. Her painstaking progress has taken hours, and the sun has set. This leads to outdoor ant activity dropping off, and makes her progress easier. Only then does she reach the summit. The ants have built a stumpy spire here, as already observed, and atop it is something new, a pale crystal that gleams translucently in the moonlight. She has no idea what this is for, and so she waits in the hope that the ants themselves will show her. After the moon begins to dip towards the far horizon, they do. All of a sudden, there are ants issuing out onto the mound's summit in considerable numbers, so that Portia must move rapidly and keep moving until she has found somewhere that they do not intend to occupy, which means some way further back down the shallow gradient. The insects are forming a carpet, a net of their bodies, touching antennae and limbs. Portia is baffled. They seem to be awaiting something, or that is how she interprets their behaviour. It is un-ant-like. It concerns her. Then, another of the insects emerges from a small hole at the base of the spire and climbs up it. It flicks one antennae towards the crystal, with the other directed downwards to make contact with the general host gathered below it. Portia's wide, round eyes gather as much of the moonlight as they can and focus on this newcomer, this small, unprepossessing ant. It has a prosthesis on its antenna, like the tree cutters. But this is a fine cap of the same material, metal, though Portia does not know that, that tapers to invisibility, so that the ant is now touching the crystal with a tiny, delicate, hair-like wire. And as Portia watches, the ants begin to dance. She has never seen anything like it. Shivers go through the entire mat of them, apparently originating in that contact between metal feeler and crystal, and spreading through the assembled host. They're sent into constant waves of motion, each transmitting to its neighbours some rhythmic message that holds the entire congregation rapt. Portia watches in quiet bewilderment. She is no mathematician. She does not quite grasp the series of arithmetical progressions, series and transformations that are represented in the waves of motion passing through the ants, no more than the ants themselves do. But she can grasp that there is some pattern there, some significance to what she is seeing. She does her best to interpret what she sees in light of her experiences, and those experiences she has inherited. But there is nothing comparable in the whole history of her own world. The ants feel the same. Their constant exploration of possibilities has resulted in this solitary contact with something vast and intangible. And the colony processes the information it receives and attempts to find a purpose for it. More and more of its biological processing power being applied to the task, more and more ants quivering under the pulsed rhythms of a distant radio signal. Intent on trying to find pattern and plan in the scene before her, Portia's hungry eyes note one more element, and she wonders, is that important? Like humans, Portia's people are quick to see patterns, sometimes when there are none. Hence, she makes the association quickly, seeing the timing as too close to be coincidental. When the gathering of ants breaks up and hurries inside, without warning and all at once, it is just as the traveller, the swift-moving star that she has often watched coursing across the sky, is passing beneath the horizon. She makes a plan then, swiftly and without much forethought. She is intrigued, and her species is driven to investigate anything new, just as the ants are. Though in very different ways. Once most of the ants are gone, she approaches the spire carefully, wary of triggering some alarm. Lifting her palps, she lets the wind ruffle them, feeling its strength and direction, and matching her movements to it. She ascends carefully, foot over foot, until she finds the crystal before her. It does not seem so large, not to her. She sets to spinning a complex package of silk that she holds with her rear legs. She is keenly aware of being at the very centre of the great colony. A mistake at this point would go very badly. She has left matters almost too late. Her presence, through the vibrations of her work, has been detected. From its hole at the spire's base, the small ant that led the congregation abruptly emerges and touches one of her feet with its uncovered antenna. Immediately it lets out an alarm, a chemical sharp with outrage and fury at finding an alien, an intruder in this place. As the scent passes outwards, it is picked up by tunnel guards and other castes that have remained close to the exterior. The message is passed on and multiplied. Portia drops on the ant beneath her and kills it with one bite, removing its head as she did with the others, although she knows she cannot bluff her way out of this one. Instead, she scuttles up the spire again, seeking as much height as it will give, and seizes the crystal from the top. She secures her two trophies to her abdomen with webbing